Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having more fun than I should be allowed to have. Jimmy Akins here, and we've got a whole bunch of questions from the internet, and I love to read the internet names. It's, you know, life's small pleasures. So No, because you have helped me with that by adding spaces. Because I couldn't read them when they were all jammed up as single words. So, like, the next guy is carbonated dipping jam 4970. If I saw that, like, on the internet, it would all be squished together, right, as one word?
Yeah.
That's hopeless for me. I just don't have that kind of brain. So I do appreciate that. I still struggle with some of them, but all right. Well, let's get right back to it. Now that I've said his name, carbonated dipping jam 4970. That's what Jimmy's here for, to answer questions. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And this is what carbonated dipping jam 4970 wanted to ask. Supposing a cannibal eats a Christian, and then the cannibal gets converted, who gets which bits in the resurrection?
Well, we don't know because we're not told. So this is a matter that we don't have a definitive answer to. We can speculate on it a little bit. In the Middle Ages, it was speculated that at least some of the matter that passed through our bodies and was in our body at the time of the of our death would end up in our resurrection bodies. So some of the matter that was in the cannibal's body at the time of the cannibal's death, since obviously the Christian's death seems to precede the cannibal's death in this scenario.
Yeah.
So some of the matter that was in the Christian's body at his death will end up in his resurrected form, and some of the matter that was in the cannibal at the time of his death will end up in the cannibal's resurrected form. But there's no specific teaching that it has to be, you know, any particular chunk of that matter. And so so that's an open, you know, exactly what it's going to be is going to be left up to God. It's also doubtful that hardly any of the matter that the cannibal consumed is going to end up in his body. I mean, it depends on when he ate the Christian, but most of what we eat is not necessarily going to be incorporated into our physical form, especially permanently, because number one, our bodies are not that efficient in terms of extracting energy and nutrients from what we consume. That's why we have poop and urine, is because those are the parts we're not using. Then a good bit of what we do extract from the food we eat is used as chemical energy to fuel our bodily processes, and it ends up getting released, if nothing else, in terms of heat, or it gets, you know, released in terms of you know, just moving around and things like that. And so so that didn't become permanently part of us either. And then even if we do incorporate some of the matter that we've consumed into our bones and muscles and cells and so forth, we have not much of it's going to go into the bones if you're an adult, because our bones don't grow very much while we're an adult. I mean, they do repair fractures and stuff, and we have all kinds of microfractures happening regularly, especially in our teeth, because they and our jaws, because they're put under more stress than most of our bones are. And so there's an ongoing replenishment of you know, to heal those microfractures in our teeth. There's an interesting story about that I'll tell you in a moment. But most of what we get is not going to be put in our bones. So that would mean it's in other bodily tissues. But other bodily tissues besides our bones have a fairly rapid turnover rate. So unless you ate the guy at a very precise, limited space before you yourself die, you're going to have almost none of him in you anyway. So, because either you didn't absorb it the first time, or it got used as chemical energy, or it was in your cells, but then they turned over, and so it ceased to be in your cells. So, there's not going to be a lot that is there, and so God's got lots of options to pick from. You might propose that that since the cannibal did something wrong here, that he's going to end up not with the best bits, that the Christian who he ate is going to end up with the best bits. But we're so far into, we don't know how this works, that I think we just got to leave it up to God. Now, everything I've said thus far is based on the traditional theological understanding of this question. More recently, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith and the International Theological Commission that it operates have noted that there isn't a guarantee that God's going to necessarily take matter from our final form of our body in order to compose our resurrected body. If God wanted, he could come up with completely new matter that was never part of us and rebuild our resurrected body. At least that's held up as a possibility today. There's also another possibility, depending on your interpretation of quantum mechanics, that I can mention, which is maybe both the Christian and the cannibal end up with the same particles appearing in two places at once. So
what just happened? Carbonated.
Yeah. So that's you know, an additional possibility. Now, I promise you an interesting story.
Okay. Yes.
Connected with the microfractures that occur in our teeth. Okay. So, you know, our bones and especially our teeth are composed with a lot of calcium. And calcium is an element, you know, it occupies a particular column on the periodic table. And the reason the periodic table is called periodic is because everything in the same column on the periodic table has similar chemical properties. And so there are like eight periods on the periodic table. When you come back around, the eighth element is going to be in the same column. It's going to have similar chemical properties. That's why, for example, if you don't want to have salt, which is sodium chloride, you could have potassium chloride as a salt substitute, because potassium is in the same column as sodium. And so it tastes kind of like sodium. So potassium chloride tastes kind of like sodium chloride. Well, okay, guess what else is in the same column as calcium? Radium. And radium is a radioactive element. And so what happens is if you ingest radium, your body will see it as if it's calcium.
Uh-oh.
And it will try to rebuild your jaws and your teeth with the radium instead of the calcium. And there have been some frightening results of that in history that I may one day tell on Mysterious World. For example, there was this drink that they had back in the day called Radiothor. And Radiothor was basically water that had a little bit of radium infused into it. And the idea was, you know, radium releases energy, right? So, I mean, that's what radioactivity is. So if you drink Radiothor, it will release energy and you'll feel more energetic.
Oh, man.
And so it was marketed as a health topic.
Oh.
And there was this millionaire who was fabulously wealthy, who could afford all the Radiothor he wanted to drink.
No.
And so he did. He thought he was taking it as a health tonic. He's drinking Radiothor every day. And his body was taking the radium and replacing the calcium in his jaw with it. And eventually his jaw kind of fell off. And so it didn't end up well for him. There were other people. These individuals are known as the Radium Girls. And what they did was they worked in watch factories, because back in the day, you know, when people wore watches, they would often have glow in the dark watches. And what made it glow, and what made the numbers and the hands glow in the dark, was radium, because it releases radioactivity, and so it would glow in the dark. And so they would have this radium paint that they would use to paint the watch faces so that people could read them in the dark. And so you have this whole factory full of women who are using radium paint, and they've got their paint brushes and they're dipping it in radium paint, and then they're painting the dials, and then they pass them on and they turn into watches. Okay, except how do you make sure you've got a good point on your brush?
Tip it on your tongue.
On your, that's right. You put it on your tongue and you get the radium paint in your mouth, and the same thing happened to them.
Aww.
So
poor radium girls.
Yeah, but this is an illustration of how even when we're adults, our bones do still grow some.
Oh, man. I mean, I feel bad for the radium girls. Carbonated dipping jam. Thank you for that disgusting question, and because it got us a fascinating answer. Now we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Catholic Influencers is a great podcast from Australia. It studies the weekly readings and breaks them down into layman's terms, showing you how they're relevant to our life today, making theology accessible for everyone. You can hear Catholic Influencers as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click Podcast Central today.
I just feel so bad for the radium girls. Yeah. I'm going to get over that. Again, thanks for everybody who sends in their questions. We gather up the internet questions for Jimmy sometimes, and we have these fun shows where we take the internet questions, and I get to read the names. Noah Perry is, and that seems like a regular name. I can't figure out I think that's a real name. Noah Perry.
Most people don't have 9167 as part of their
name. Well, that's true. I thought he could be the 9167th Noah Perry. I don't know. Noah asks this, is the requirement to receive communion to not be conscious of mortal sin or grave sin? I ask because the official canon law says grave sin, but grave sins can be venial in the case of addiction.
Yeah, this is a drafting issue in some recent church documents. Oh. Traditionally, the classical language of mortal sin was used, historically, but then in the last few decades, a decision was made to speak in official church documents like the Code of Canon Law more in terms of grave sin, but it means the same thing. When they say grave sin, they mean mortal sin. It's confusing. I would have advised them to stick with the traditional language because it's what everybody understands. But they mean grave sin that you are fully culpable for. They don't mean something that has been mitigated down to venial level.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. So Noah, thank you very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Good Lord. Caius Hospitalis, 1707. Caius Hospitalis, 1707 asks this. Hello, Mr. Akin. Could you clarify the Catholic teachings on burial, specifically concerning what is and isn't permitted and what is preferred? I've been told that cremation isn't forbidden, but scattering ashes is, due to our desire to respect the body. Thank you for all you do. You helped me a lot on my journey to Catholicism.
So in terms of, in terms of how the question is phrased, he asks about burial. And burial is something that can happen with either an intact body or parts of a body, like if someone's been dismembered or something, or it can happen with ashes. And in terms of what's permitted on burial, there's an expectation that people are going to be buried in the Catholic Church. They're going to be buried in some form. And so you're not allowed to just like leave a body outdoors to be eaten by microorganisms. You know, you're supposed to bury it. And that could be the whole body or it could be parts of the body. I should mention that it also is possible to donate a body to science, for example, or parts of the body to science. So in those cases, you don't bury whatever's been donated, you know. But if that hasn't happened, you do bury it, whether it's intact or in parts or cremated. Now, when it comes to cremation, the historic practice has been, you're right, you're not supposed to just scatter the ashes, because if you do that, it destroys the memory of the person. There's no place like where the ashes are interred so that people can go and pray for the person and remember the person and stuff like that. It's not that it's against divine law to scatter the ashes. The church hasn't said that, but it's our practice to keep the ashes together. However, there has been a modification on that point just recently. One of the questions, because, and this is actually based on something that happens with non-cremated bodies. If you go to Europe, for example, you will see in various monasteries what are known as ossuaries. Now, classically, an ossuary was a box that you put the bones of a person in after the flesh had deteriorated off of them. And they used ossuaries a lot back in Jesus's day. What they would do is they would put the body on a niche in a tomb and come back in a year. And by the time they came back, the flesh had largely rotted away from the bones. And so they then cleaned the bones and put them in a box known as an ossuary, where they would be, and then they'd reinter the ossuary, and that would be the person's form of long-term burial. Well, ossuaries have taken other forms in other ages. And so if you go to some monasteries where in Europe, where, you know, you've had the monks living in this monastery for centuries, what some of them have done is build the ossuary itself. This is like a big room. They've built it out of the bones of the former monks who used to be in that monastery. And so you can go in and like the walls are made out of the bones of former monks, and they've got, you know, lamps hanging from the ceiling that are made out of the bones, that kind of like chandeliers that are made out of the bones of former monks. And the reason they do this is it's a memento mori. Memento mori means remember death. And so Christians down through history have periodically had reminders of the fact that we're all going to die. And those reminders are called memento mori. And so for the monks in the monastery, building a room out of the bones of the former monks is a pretty good memento mori. And so, so you do have situations where the body parts of multiple people are mixed together. So you've got multiple skeletons being mixed together here. And that led to a question that the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith recently answered. Could you do the same thing with ashes after a cremation? Now, they're not really ashes, because what happens in a cremation is the flesh burns away and gets basically turned into smoke. What's left over is the bones of the person, and then they crush the bones, and the cremated remains or cremains that they give you after a cremation, it's actually crushed bone, not ashes per se. But if you can do this with intact skeletons, could you do it with crushed skeletons? Could you do it with, you know, the cremains or the ashes after cremation? And the DDF said, yeah, you can do that. You can take at least some of the ashes that, you know, that came from a cremation and mix them with other ashes from other people. But if you do that, we want you to preserve the names of the people who are in this kind of ash pool, So that just like in a monastery, the names of the former monks are remembered, so people can still pray for them and stuff like that. And so you can essentially do the same thing. You can mix the ashes of different people as long as you preserve a record of their identities, so they can still be prayed for by name and so forth. And so that's the most recent ruling. So there has been development in terms of Catholic practice as opposed to doctrine. But there's been a development in terms of Catholic practice happening with respect to cremated remains, and we may see that trajectory continue into the future.
All righty. Thank you very much, Caius, for that question. This one comes from Daniels, 7250. Can you explain the problem with Islam? Is the word of Allah separate from Allah?
Okay, so... Well, the problem with Islam is it's based on a false revelation. The angel Gabriel did not really appear to Muhammad and narrate to him all the stuff that's in the Quran. So that's the fundamental problem with Islam. It's just based on a false set of revelations. In terms of is the word of Allah separate from Allah in Islamic thought? So Allah is just the Arabic word for God. Allah is not a different God. It's just the Arabic word for God. Jewish Arab speakers refer to God as Allah. Christian Arabs refer to God as Allah. It's just the word for God. It's a cognate of the Aramaic word Allah, which is the same. It's just the vowel's a little different, but it's the same root word. So the question becomes, is the word of God separate from God? Well, in Islamic thought, yes, because they don't have the concept that we Christians do of the logos, or word of God. You know, in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. So we've got that concept where God and his word can be understood as the same. So that's why Jesus is divine as the word of God. But they don't have that concept. So the word of God, as found in the Quran, is understood to be distinct from God. It is not the same as God. It is something that comes from God, but it is not itself God.
Daniels, thank you very much. I hope that one was helpful. This one comes from Hemlock 999. What was Jesus's life like in childhood and adolescence?
Well, we're not given a lot of information. We have an appearance of Jesus when he's 1 or 2 years old. That's when the Magi visit. We also have another appearance when he's 12 years old that's mentioned in Scripture, where he gets lost and found in the temple. But beyond that, we're not given a lot of information. Luke says after they find him in the temple that he went to Nazareth and was obedient to Joseph and Mary. So Luke makes sure after that temple finding thing, he wants to make sure we understand he was not disobedient to Mary and Joseph. And so we know he was obedient. We're told he grew in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. So he had a positive, godly childhood. We also know his parents were in the lower class. Economically, his father, Joseph, is a tectone, to use the Greek word. It means a workman, not necessarily a carpenter, but someone who works with their hands. And we know that they didn't have a lot of money because Mary, for her purification, offers a dove, which is what you offered if you were too poor to afford a more expensive animal. So he basically had a lower class lifestyle growing up as a child in Galilee that was pretty typical for the time. He learned his trade from his father, which was typical for the time. And he was a godly child who was obedient to his parents. But beyond that, we don't have a lot of data.
That was Hemlock. Hemlock 999. Thanks very much for that one. I think we've got time. I'm going to try Zaro Bass. Zaro Bass has a question. What is the Catholic understanding of free will, and how can we argue for it? It would also be great if you could show how it affects the Catholic view of predestination.
Okay, so we're going to have the hard break coming up here in a minute, so I'm likely to have to finish this on the other side of the hard break. But basically, the Catholic understanding of free will is what's sometimes called libertarian free will, as opposed to compatibilist free will. So in philosophy, libertarian free will is the kind of free will that a person has if nothing outside of them determines what they're going to do. And broadly speaking, Catholic theology is, you're not, nothing outside of you forces you to do what you're going to do, and nothing inside of you forces you to do what you're going to do. And that's the kind of freedom that's known as libertarian. On the other hand, compatibilist free will is understands that there are things, there are prior conditions to you making a decision that dictate what you're going to do. But there's more to say about that, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
All right, we'll be right back, Zaro, to get the rest of the answer to your question and lots more questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, right in the middle of an answer for an internet question from Zaro Bass. And the question is basically, what is the Catholic understanding of free will and how can we argue for it?
Okay, so just to recap, the Catholic understanding of free will is basically what's called in philosophy libertarian free will, which is that when you make a decision, there is no set of prior factors, either inside of you or outside of you, that determine what choice you will make. The choice is itself a free choice. There is another kind of free will, though, called compatibilism. And the idea here is that there is a kind of free will that is compatible with the idea that everything is determined. Now, in the first kind of free will we mentioned, in libertarian free will, you notice how I said prior events do not determine what choice you make, either prior events outside of you or inside of you. So this is a form that is not complete determinism because your choices are not determined by anything else. But there are some people who want to say, no, everything is determined, including your choices, but they're still compatible with free will somehow. And so compatibilist free will typically says that there are prior factors such as your own desires, that determine what you will choose. But because no one is forcing you to make the choice you do, you're just choosing in accordance with your desires, you still have meaningful freedom. And so that's the compatibilist position. They want to say free will is compatible with everything being determined. Well, that is not the Catholic view. That view is advocated by Calvinists, but not by Catholics. Catholics want to see a more robust freedom where your desires or whatever do not simply determine what you choose. You can choose contrary to your desires. So there are some complicating factors, though. Like in Catholicism, the Thomistic position is actually pretty close to Calvinism. The challenge is then for Thomists to be able to articulate how their views regarding predestination and so forth, which are quite similar to Calvinist views, how they don't remove free will. So this is the problem for Thomists. How do you both maintain your predestinarian beliefs, which are very strict, and at the same time preserve free will? And non-Thomists typically look at what Thomists say and say, you guys aren't doing it. Your views on predestination imply a lack of freedom, and you haven't mounted a convincing defense for why we still are free in the way the Bible and the church envisions our freedom. You've effectively squashed free will or true freedom out of your system. So that's both the Thomistic idea and the criticism of the Thomistic idea. So that's where the debate focuses in Catholic circles is, you know, with regard to Thomism, is have they adequately preserved free will or not? And people can have different opinions about that. Now, in terms of predestination can work in a number of different ways. If we're talking about predestination to salvation, which is actually not what's mentioned in the Bible, but we can still talk about it theologically. If we're talking about predestination to salvation, it could be that that God looks at what people choose to do in history, and then assigns people a destiny to either heaven or hell based on their free choices. So if people freely choose to cooperate with God's grace, he determines a destiny for them of heaven. And if they freely choose to reject God's grace, he determines a destiny of them for hell. So in this case, predestination is based on the choices that people freely make with this libertarian free will. And this understanding of predestination actually has support in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. If you look at paragraph 600 of the Catechism, it's talking about Jesus's predestination to go to the cross. But it says in paragraph 600 that everything in history is present to God he's outside of time. So everything is present to God in its immediacy, the past, the present, and the future. And so God, when he formulates his plan of predestination, he sees people's free will choices and incorporates them into his plan. So in this case, it's not like God forced Judas to betray Jesus or forced Caiaphas to convict Jesus or forced Pilate to execute Jesus. Instead, when God from his eternal now looks at AD 33, he sees Judas, Caiaphas, and Pilate doing those things freely, and he incorporates them into his plan. So Jesus ends up being predestined to go to the cross. But the way the passage is formulated, it seems to be articulating a more general principle. You know, it says, you know, that God incorporates the free will decisions of people when he makes his plan of predestination. That makes it sound like a general principle. And so that would support the idea that predestination works by God in seeing what people freely choose to do and then incorporating their free will decisions into his plan. So that's one way that predestination can work. But Calvinists and Thomists are going to disagree with that. What they're going to say is that, nope, God does not base his predestination of people on their free choices. Instead, he bases his predestination of people on nothing at all other than his own choice. So on this view, and in Calvinist circles, this is called unconditional election. On this view, God just picks certain people, not based on anything about that person, not based on their free will decisions. He just picks certain people based on his own choice, and says, this person's going to heaven. And he either picks or passes over other people who therefore go to hell. And so the determination of whether you're predestined to heaven or hell on this view is not based on your choices. Instead, it's based on God either picking you or not picking you based on nothing other than his own will. And so that's what Calvinists and Thomists are going to say. So that is a permitted opinion in the Catholic Church, but it's a little then hard to square with robust free will, because obviously God has said if you don't respond to his grace, you're not going to go to heaven. So it would seem that if God just arbitrarily picks you to go to heaven, you're going to be forced to accept his grace. It doesn't look like you have meaningful free will in that case. So that's a sketch of how these concepts relate. I could obviously say more, and I'm having to compress things for time reasons. But if you'd like to learn more, I've been covering this on the Jimmy Akin podcast lately. You might want to check out episode 2 about how God's foreknowledge works, and you might want to check out episode 12 on whether everything is predestined. And you know, there are a few other episodes you might want to check out, because I've kind of been exploring this area on the Jimmy Akin podcast lately.
Zaro Bass, thank you very much for the question. We've got time to do another one before we have to take any more breaks. And Nyrock Dayrog 3973 asks this: what are cardinals, and how did that position become established?
Okay, so the term cardinal comes from a Latin term, cardo, which means hinge, so like the hinge of a door. And hinges are what things turn on. You know, the door turns on its hinges. And so what happened was, over in Rome, they had a bunch of clergy. You know, the Pope is at the top, but then he's got other priests and stuff working for him, and deacons and stuff like that. And some of these ended up being important people that the Pope would like rely on for, like, if he's making decisions, he would have them as counselors, or he would entrust them with specific tasks. And so these people became known as the cardos, as the hinges, which eventually became the cardinals. And so the cardinals are like the hinge people, the hinge personnel in Rome that the Pope relies upon to get stuff done. They're his counselors. They execute tasks for him. They elect the new Pope when there's a vacancy. So they're like the hinge guys. They're the guys everything turns on. Now, originally, all of the cardinals were members of the clergy in Rome that, like, grew up in Rome or whatever, or at least were based there permanently. But what happened over time was the Pope decided he wanted some broader representation than just the local clergy. So he would appoint cardinals from other parts of the world to perform these functions for him. So, like, for example, the Archbishop of Paris or the Archbishop of Los Angeles might be appointed a cardinal. And what that would mean is they technically do have a position in Rome, as there are certain churches in Rome where, like, the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris will also be a cardinal priest of this church in Rome, or a cardinal deacon of this church in Rome. So they're technically members of the Roman clergy of the city of Rome, even though they spend most of their time in Paris or in Los Angeles or in Buenos Aires or wherever they may be based. So they have kind of a split gig going. Most of the time they're in their home diocese, wherever it is, but they also technically are a clergy member of a church in Rome, and thus a member of the Roman clergy And so cardinals are still the hinge members of the Roman clergy, but a lot of them are not actually based in Rome these days.
Nyrock, Dayrog, thanks very much for the question. It's Ask Me Anything for Jimmy Akin of the internet variety today. Lots more internet questions to come for Jimmy right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1999. The shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hansville, Alabama is consecrated. Mother Angelica says, "The happiest day of my life was the day this church was dedicated."
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and we've got lots more questions from the internet for him today. And this one comes from Traditional Girl 3943. And Traditional Girl wants to know this: I know that God brings a greater good from evil. He allows, and that He helps save our brothers and sisters through our efforts. But are those the only answers to why God would allow tens of millions of people to starve under Mao or Stalin? Or why so many people, including children, are trafficked and satanically ritually abused? I mean, the scale of human pain is mind-blowing. Is the realization of our impotence in the face of evil and our need to surrender to God for help the point? Thank you.
Okay, so once again, we're looking at the problem of evil. The answer to the problem of evil is always the same. And you've already said it, Traditional Girl. God would not allow an evil to exist unless He was going to bring about an equal or greater good through that very evil. So we can then speculate on what that evil is. And in the case of moral evils, like murdering tens of millions of people or allowing tens of millions of people to starve, free will is an important factor. You know, God wants love. That's His highest priority. That's why it's both the first and the second great commandments is love God and love your neighbor. But He wants love that's freely chosen. And so in order to allow the free will to freely choose love, He must allow that free will to be abused. And in some cases, like Mao or Stalin, people have gotten themselves into positions in society where when they misuse their free will, it has horrific consequences. God will ultimately bring about greater good from that, and we can speculate on what that good is, but usually we can't know for sure in this life. So we have to trust God, because we're kind of in the position of small children. You know, sometimes parents, for the good of the children, allow the children to experience painful things. Like if you're a small child, your parents are likely to take you to the doctor so you can get vaccinated. And at the time, you know, you as a small child, you don't understand the purpose of the vaccination. It just seems scary and painful to you. But as you grow up, you learn, okay, there was a reason for that. By having this tiny little small amount of pain with the vaccination, it spared me a horrific disease later in life. And so we can appreciate from an adult perspective what are the decisions of our parents. Well, that's essentially the position we're in now with respect to God. We're like little kids. We don't have a big perspective on the world and what's ultimately going to happen as a result of the pain that we suffer. But we can trust God that in the, let's say, in the next life, when we have more information than we have in this life, we'll be able to appreciate the perspective, and then we can understand exactly why God allowed particular evils. But most of the time now, we just can't know. And so if one is in the midst of suffering, it's understandable that one is concerned about this. But once you understand the principles, unless you're in the midst of extreme suffering, you're not going to be able to make a lot of progress in terms of figuring it out. So, you know, it's not worth spending a lot of time on, because you won't be able to make a lot of progress. There are just things we don't know in this life. I will also have one note. Traditional Girl mentions large numbers of children being trafficked, and that's true. There is human trafficking, including children, and it is present on a large scale in the world. But she also mentions them being satanically ritually abused, and that actually is not common. I'm not saying it never happens, but back in the 1990s, there was what's called the Satanic Panic, where there were all these reports of satanic ritual abuse happening, and people's lives were ruined, and they were sent to jail. And it turned out that a lot of it was based on false memory syndrome, where counselors actually unintentionally induced people to have memories of things that never actually happened. And so that led to a situation where there were a lot of exaggerated claims regarding satanic ritual abuse. It's not that it doesn't happen, but it is very rare. And so so I would just urge a little bit of caution in that regard. And I hope that's helpful.
Thank you very much, Traditional Girl. This one comes from Rich. If we will have free will in heaven, will it happen again that some might have the choice of being fallen angels and the repercussions thereof? This would be when the kingdom of God arrives on earth and after final judgment.
Yeah, so the standard view has always historically been, no, once we're in heaven, we're going to be confirmed in goodness. Our life choice becomes fixed at the point of our death, and so we're not going to fall again. We're not going to have to worry about falling into sin. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, and the same thing has been the traditional view of angels, that their life choice became fixed at some point in the past, and so the ones who chose not to fall, they're not going to fall at any point in the future. However, as I mentioned, there is some indication in the Bible that angels may have fallen at different times, and that raises some interesting questions in this area. It's not certain that they fell at different times, but there are hints of that. And if those hints reflect reality, which they may not, then it would raise some interesting questions, at least for the angels and how their wills work. But in terms of our wills, I would stick with the standard view that, once you're a human and you're dead, you don't fall again.
Rich, thank you for the question. This one comes from Timbo Slice 980. Recently, a real archaeologist, Flint Dibble, debated Graham Hancock, a pseudo-archaeologist. Are you still...
By the way, for an archaeologist, Flint Dibble is a great name.
I know. I almost felt like, how is he the real archaeologist? That sounds like a movie archaeologist. Are you, Jimmy, still planning on doing an episode on pseudo-archaeology? Would you consider interviewing someone like him for it? There seems to be a war brewing between mainstream archaeology and a few camps of pseudo archaeology online. I have to admit, I was in one of these camps until I watched a good volume of your material.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that my material has been helpful to you. So this is more of a mysterious world question, and I do plan on doing future episodes on aspects of archaeology, including pseudo archaeology, and, you know, critiquing it and talking about what the problems with it are. In terms of bringing on an interview in someone like Graham Hancock, I wouldn't rule it out altogether, but I tend not to interview people I'm going to be critiquing, because it's I want to be fair to everybody, and bringing someone on just to critique the person is something that it's not that I would never do it, but it's something that I would be very careful about doing. Because if someone's walking into a debate, at a minimum, they need to know that, because otherwise it's not fair to them. And so I tend to actually avoid interviewing people if I'm going to offer a critique of that person. So I would have a critique of Graham Hancock. And so I probably would be less likely to interview him so that I could give an unencumbered critique.
All right. Thank you very much for the question and for allowing me to read the name Flint Dibble. Rebecca asks this question. I would like to know if it's true that Our Lady of Fatima told Lucia that Francesco would pass and his soul would be in purgatory until the end of time.
Go ahead.
Okay. It is hard to believe that a child would have such horrible sins that would keep him there for so long.
Well, so in regard to the question, is it true? The answer is no. It seems that Rebecca may be thinking of two different events. One of them was there was apparently a young girl in Fatima who had, I guess, died and had a reputation for doing immoral stuff. And allegedly, Mary told Lucy that that girl would be in purgatory until the end of time. But she didn't say that about Francesco. Instead, what she said was he'll go to heaven, but he needs to pray a lot of rosaries. So it seems like these two different events are what you're thinking of. And I would also note, even if Mary told Lucy this, well, it didn't happen because Francesco is a saint. He's in heaven now. And
oh,
so
yeah, right.
He didn't spend the rest of time in purgatory. On the other hand, I agree that the claim that a child could commit such horrible sins that they need that much time to be purified is not entirely plausible. And in fact, we don't even know that time exists in purgatory the way it does here. Purgatory, as Pope Benedict XVI said in his encyclical Spes Salvi, its duration cannot be calculated in earthly time. So it could be instantaneous for all we know. But it's certainly hard to imagine a child being so disordered that they would require the rest of world history in order to be purified. Of course, we don't know how long the rest of world history is. Maybe it's not that long. But this brings up another point, which has been discussed recently by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. If you look at their norms that were released in 2024, and this is there in seed form, even in the 1978 norms, but they become more explicit about it. There is a human element in private revelation. So you can't just take what a visionary reports and say, oh, that's exactly what Mary said. You know, if it seems like there are problems with it, like there are problems in this case, like how could a child possibly be that sinful and so forth, then there's a good likelihood that Mary either didn't say it or didn't say it exactly that way, or it's not being remembered in exactly the way Mary said it. So I would say if there was this girl who had a reputation for doing things she shouldn't, that would be an indication that she's going to be in purgatory. And maybe Mary said something like she's going to be there for a long time, you know, from a child's perspective, a long time, which, you know, how time moves for children, you know, yeah, a year seems like forever. And that got understood by Lucia, who's a very young child at this time. That got understood as like the equivalent of the rest of the history of the world. But I would think it's very doubtful that Mary would have actually literally said this.
Rebecca, thank you. I think people say Lucia, and I said Lucia, and I think it's because they have this new character, Luce.
It's actually because in Portuguese, the C is pronounced as an S, not a CH.
Yeah, so but in Italian,
in Portuguese, it's Lucia, not Lucia.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I think I said Lucia because I was thinking of Luce, the little the little Italian pilgrim. Well, thank you, Jimmy. I always enjoy the 2 hours with you. That was a lot of fun.
My pleasure.
Check out Jimmy's work at, well, you can look up, just search for the Jimmy Akin podcast, search for Mysterious World. If you want to go directly to Mysterious World, go to mysterious.fm. All of it is on YouTube. All of it is also anywhere where you get your podcasts. Thank you to everybody who sent their questions in. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.